welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you so much for joining us as we continue these series of programs bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true and looking for those new ways of living, as we say on each program. We are here 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Sunday morning and evening, Monday morning at 1 a.m., and that's Pacific time, streaming live at those times, as well as providing you with the podcast through SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, and a lot of other places that folks are linking us to. Thank you for that. That is most gratefully appreciated when it comes to the expansion of these ideas. And the reason that we are doing this program is to provide you with information from our guests so that you can continue your evolutionary process, continue your growth, your education, inspiration, and so on and so forth. So stay with us. We have a lot coming your way today. I think you're going to enjoy this program. I know that I am. As I was sharing with our guest before we got started, as I watched the film that is out, it's called Perception. Seeing is not believing. We'll find out about that. I went through several personal growth and development programs in the 80s and 90s, as well as obviously doing interviews and reading all kinds of books and all of this, and having the various experiences of acquaintances, good friends, and so forth, who have facilitated my evolutionary process over the past, well, I'll just say since I was 17. And we're going to continue that for both myself as well as you and our special guest here on the program. And we're going to talk with James. Give me the last name, because here it is. I'm going to have you pronounce it because I know I'm going to mess it up the first time.
Purpura.
Okay. So James Purpura and your wife, Steph, who was going to join us but is a little under the weather. So we send her good energy and good thoughts for a speedy recovery. But you folks, you've been involved in the, shall we say, the personal growth and development area, the evolutionary process of man for how long?
So it's been about 16, 17 years now.
And it started how for you?
So for me, it started in a jail cell. Matter of fact, a solitary confinement jail cell. It was at that moment I had been after some brutal childhood experiences, after trying to do my best at life for a long time, failing and failing over again, I checked out of the game through drugs. And at some point to support my habit, I started, cutting checks, doing some small crime in order to support my habit. And I ended up in jail and I made the wrong police officer mad at me. So I ended up in solitary confinement and I was there for about 15 months.
Wow. And so what was the catalytic event that said to you, either A, there's got to be a better way of living, or B, I've got to change my life or I'm going to die?
So there were two events when I was sitting in the cell. The first one was after when I hit that cell door, it's a very depressing place because you only get out of your cell 1 hour every other day. Right. And, you're all alone. You can shower at that time. You can look at the sky through a concrete box. But the first 2 weeks I was there, it was the first time in my life that I was completely depressed. And I slept for two straight weeks. I mean, I literally slept until I couldn't sleep anymore. You guys close my door. So from that point forward, when I woke up, one day I got a letter from my father, right? And what the letter said, he wasn't a really intuitive, deep man, but he said, "Look, buddy, I don't know how long you're going to be there, but most people don't get the opportunity to fully focus on themselves and learn how to grow you know, I don't know how long you're going to be there, but don't let that time go to waste. And I really took that letter to heart, right? Because I didn't know, because I was awaiting trial, I didn't know how long I was going to be there either, right? And so I knew that whatever information I had got me to where I was, and I needed information. So I started, you know, meeting with the jail psychologist. I started getting all the books that I could get, right? I started writing organizations that, you know, sent books to people in my situation to get more books. And I started reading and studying. That was the first thing that happened to me.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us about the process that you went through from that point.
Well, what I started to do was, a lot of the books that I read started talking about meditation. So I attempted to start meditating, you know, and so every day I would meditate and I'd work out in my cell. I'd do push-ups and sit-ups and I'd try to improve my body. And I kept reading these self-help books or these meditation books, you know, sometimes books on psychology and things like that. And so one day I was reading a book about forgiveness. And so I decided that I was going to write this list of all the people I felt like in my life that I needed to forgive, you know? And at this point you need to understand that I felt very much like a victim, like things were happening to me mm-hmm. because I had a pretty crappy life and a lot of bad things had happened to me. So it felt like everything was happening to me. So you can imagine this was a really long list. And I looked down at this piece of paper and I'd been staring at it for days and I went through and I tried to do some meditations, some forgiveness at it, but I continued to stare at this piece of paper. And then one day it hit me. The only common denominator between all those situations is in fact me. And the next thought that came was, what if I'm somehow the cause or I created all of these situations? So I really spent some time thinking about what that meant. And here's where I got to. If I wasn't the creator of all of my situations, you know, or the creator of my life, that meant that life really was a place, you know, or was really crappy. And I probably didn't want to play anymore, right? Because that meant that I was always going to be stuck, that my life was always going to be bad because that's all I'd known to that point. And the other side of that coin was, well, if I did create my experiences, then that meant if I figured out how I could create something new in its place. And so as I tossed those two things back and forth, essentially what happened was this, is that I couldn't create some of them and not others. It was that day I decided, you know, that I was the creator of my experiences, even though I didn't have any idea what that meant. And I was going to unlock the secrets to how you create, you know, things in the world. And that I was going to build a life that was. It was that day I realized later that I took my power back because I had to take responsibility for everything that ever happened to me. And that was a very powerful thing to do.
Wow. And a lot of people spend a lifetime trying to do that. I wasn't really searching myself at the age of 23, 24, 25, or even when I was 21, when I went through LifeSpring, but people could see some of these folks and they could see that, you know, you're doing good, but you know, you could be doing even better. And I'd like to offer this opportunity to you. And of course I could have said no and gone about my merry way, but I had started at the age of 17 doing my own search. My metaphysical primer is The Autobiography of a Yogi. And on this program, we've interviewed all kinds of folks from all different philosophical perspectives who are doing the same thing that you are. Is one of the most important aspects of the work that you folks do at power-u.com and the university, the coaching, all of the work, Is the biggest part of it learning about self?
So the answer to that question is, I don't know if it's the most important work. So let me kind of back up for a second, because I think what, you know, what I was getting ready to roll into is, shortly after getting out of jail, I went on this, you know, this, I decided I was going to go on this adventure to figure out the most creative elements of our lives. And shortly after that, I met my wife, Steph, and she decided to join me on this journey to rebuild her life, because she had come through some pretty awful circumstances, you know, in some ways way more awful than mine, and every way in my mind. And so we worked to figure out what was the creative elements of our lives. And here's where I'm going to back up to, is that there are things that dictate your existence here and what you create, what you see, what you do, all of your experiences. And so we set out to find those things. And, you know, I'll put it this way. You know, the two things that dictate that are your perception and your emotions. But even though those are the two things that literally make up the fabric of your life, and understanding those two things will put you in a position to create anything you want, most people don't understand those two concepts, at least not on a deep level. And so essentially what we found is, as a part of our journey, it took us 17 years to get here. You know, we made a book, we made a movie, and essentially what we did was, you know, every single night, forever, my wife and I would sit on the bed and we would talk about issues, right? And we'd talk about beliefs and perceptions in life and what that meant. You know, everybody else is watching Netflix. We're talking about issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially this is what I would tell your listeners, is that the vast majority of us either have no clue how life works and we're just bouncing around from experience to experience, or spend our entire lives trying to figure out the mechanics of how life works, and very little time actually living life. So what Steph and I did was we worked vigorously over the last 15 years to figure out the exact things that dictate your life experience. Everything that dictates happiness on the inside, contentment, well-being, and everything that detects creating money and wealth and things on the outside. And we took all of that information and crammed it into a book and in a movie, so that you don't have to guess anymore what the creative elements of your life are. And when it comes down to it, yes, it is self, but it's how the individual interacts with these two pieces of their awareness. First one being perception, the second one being emotions.
You have a philosophy, if you will, a mission statement that says that you are seekers who find the state of humanity inadequate. Before I go any further, how do you, as an individual, let alone as the organization, powerful you, make that determination? In what way, and this is almost a rhetorical question, but in what way is humanity inadequate?
Well, let me ask you a question, Richard. Do you have kids?
I do not.
Okay. Do you have nieces and nephews?
I do.
Okay. And eventually they're going to have kids.
Probably, right? Yes.
Okay, and so let me ask you a question. Is this the world you want your nieces or nephews to grow up in?
It's not even the world I want to grow up in.
Right. I mean, you know, the biggest problem is, the reason we find it inadequate is, and this is where I'm going to maybe lose some people here. The underlying principle under perception is that you do not see reality. Right? Mm-hmm. Why is that important to this conversation? Well, if you don't see reality, what do you see? You see an assumption of what you think reality is. right? My question to you is, what if that assumption is wrong? And the answer is, it's almost always wrong or very limited at best. And so the thing that I find inadequate about humanity is the thing that we can actually solve. And that is the rampant ignorance, right? Mm-hmm. Our unwillingness to look for and find answers, our unwillingness to ask the right questions. And that comes down to the individual. We have to wake people up on an individual level to show them that there is so much more available to them, right? You said something at the end of when I was talking about responsibility, like it's so hard to get people to take responsibility for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
The question is why? And the answer is actually fairly easy. And the answer is, why would I take responsibility for something if I didn't know how to change it? Because that would just cause me more pain and suffering, is number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is that we fail to calculate the cost of not taking responsibility.
Mm.
Everything has an associated cost with it.
Yeah.
And so I would welcome you to read the rest of that statement, and I think it'll...
Oh, absolutely. I don't want to leave our awesome audience hanging, but I do like to go through and get definition of terms and so forth. You also believe the unrealized potential of the individual is both the source and solution to this problem. Our goal is to inspire fellow seekers to tap into their unlimited potential through a personalized combination of philosophy, science, technology, and community. Now, I've read the whole statement. I want to go back to the word potential. I love that word, and I'm saddened by that word because of the lost potential of individuals who are put in situations where their lives are lost. People who get involved in the military, people who are involved in crimes throughout the country, let alone the world, and on and on. Whatever the means by which the individual leaves this earthly abode is lost potential. What could that person have contributed to our society had they lived, had they been educated? And that goes to another question. You talk about how do people know? Without education, in my estimation, they'll never know. And that's why we talk about choices. How do you know to choose something different than your life is going down if you don't know there are other choices? And I've often used the entitlement programs and people who are generationally into those. Generation after generation, it's all they know. They're not getting the education in the school system they should be getting. They're not getting it from home because their parents didn't get the education they should have gotten. And so the only thing they know at this time is just keep having babies and the government will keep giving you money. And this is the way we'll live. And it's like, but there is so much more, and until people are educated, is that one of the focal points for powerful you?
So we would have to look at your terminology around education.
Okay.
Because I take a vast amount of exception to what most people think education is.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your definition of education?
My definition would be exposure to new ideas, to new ways of doing things, to learning how to critically think and process information in a way that uplifts that person and the people around them.
Great. Well, that's definitely not school.
No.
So,
no.
I mean, you know, all right, so I'm going to back up because you've said a lot there.
Okay.
Right? And now I understand a little bit more about your paradigms. I'm going to go in and I'm going to challenge a paradigm, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we have a massive recession on the way, like one that's never been experienced, you know, 20%+ unemployment coming. And here's why. The technology sector is getting ready to offset more jobs than it creates in a massive way. You know, the example I would use for this is self-driving cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, 5% of the public drives for a living. 20 years from now, there's nobody's going to be driving for a living, right? And so technology creating right now is creating more jobs than it is, in fact, replacing. But that is going to flip in a massive way. And so we are going to be in a problem that our current education system does not support us getting out of. And let me tell you why. So I want you to think about it this way. Is what does our education system currently produce? And what it produces is producers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a training course. It's not about thinking. It's not about critical thinking. It's about memorizing. And so essentially, what do we have? We have producers. We have leaders, you know, those who lead the producers, right? We have caregivers. We have mentors and teachers. And then we have, I can't remember what the last one is. But the one thing that our education system does not support is creatives. And so traditionally, the way we as a society have created creative people is by taking the people who are rejected by the system. And those people, through pure survival, either sink or swim. And one of those people rises to the top, right? Those are the people that create massive amounts of change in the world, right? And so the idea is that one creative can create millions of jobs for producers. But that's not a sustainable model. We don't foster creativity. And so one of the things I like to say, and is that life is not about answers. Life is not about being right. Life was only ever about asking the right questions. Not only are we not asking the right questions, we're not asking any questions at all. Most people don't even know what a good question is.
Mm.
And creativity does not begin with knowing. Creativity begins with stepping into the unknowing of something, which is the fear of uncertainty. So you literally have to be open to being wrong. If you want to be creative, what are you wrong about? You're wrong about just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what's going to happen is it's going to take a lot more creatives to think our way out of 20% unemployment than the current model of producing those creatives, which is massive rejection and alienation. Because that's why we see so many artists kill themselves. That's why we see so many creative, you know, sensitive people in drug rehabs, right? That's why we see so many creative, sensitive people break and end up in mental institutions. Right. And so our current model of education was fine for all of the revolutions that we have encompassed out of society till now. So, you know, that's one aspect of what we said. So education, in my mind, is exactly what you described, but that's not what they're teaching.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Period.
Yeah.
So, you know, I sit here in front of you. So there's an interesting story, and it's in the movie, but I'll tell it. So when I got out of jail, right, I said, well, I need to get educated, right? Because that's what most people do to be successful. And so I went down to the community college, and I took the entrance exam. And after I took the entrance exam, people always get hung up on the wrong part of the story, and I'll tell you where that's at. After I took the entrance exam, this woman comes out, and she was nice as she can be. She takes me into the back office. She goes, sir, you can't go to school here. I said, what do you mean I can't go to school here? And she goes, you didn't score high enough on any single subject to pass a class here. Right? So my average education was fourth to fifth grade level, straight across the board. Mm-hmm. She goes, you can't pass any classes. Right? And I looked at her and said, well, what should I do? You know, and she said, well, maybe you should go pick up a trade like construction. Right? Or, you know, you could self-educate to the point where you can get in to pass these classes. And so the point is, right, is those organizations teach skills, right? Mm-hmm. It was apparent I didn't have the skills necessary to succeed in almost anything. And so the part of the story that everybody always gets caught up on is that, oh my God, I can't believe they didn't help you, right? And I'm like, that's the wrong part of the story, right? That's the wrong part of the story. Because I didn't walk out of there and go to the city library and study up and become, you know, get those skills and then graduate top of my class. I didn't do any of that, right? So what I essentially did was I had to reflect, what are my strengths? And at that point, I had two major strengths. The first one was solving problems. The second one was when I believed in something, I could be very persuasive. I took those two skills and I turned them into millions and millions of dollars. And today, you know, if I didn't have spell check, you'd be shocked if you got an email from me. Right? I still don't have those skills.
Yeah.
What I realized is in business, nobody has all the skills.
Yeah.
So if you have them all, then you can succeed if you don't have any, because you're always going to have to find people to fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so success was never about skills. It's about asking the right questions.
I also have to say that, now I'm going to say, I don't have to say it, I'm going to say it.
Let's hear it.
The words success and failure, and I'm not trying to be PC at all, need to be stricken from our language, from our vocabulary. And here's the reason why.
Totally.
This is why
I agree totally, by the
okay.
way. I use those words because people relate to those words, but they do need to be stricken.
Absolutely. And I will give you a prime example. It's the same example I use every single time. Thomas Edison was asked, so how many times did you fail before you got the light bulb to work? He says, I never failed. I just found 990 ways it didn't work. If education, and we're talking about a proper institutionalized education, a good one, a profitable one, if you will, for the student, not for the institution, is an evolutionary process. You start in first kindergarten, maybe preschool, and you work your way up through first, third, eighth, 10th, 12th, go on to post-secondary, maybe graduate school, get your PhD, etc. That is an evolutionary process. So when you talk about creativity, and I couldn't agree with you more, it's an evolutionary process. It's not a pass-fail, failure-succeed process. It's an evolutionary process. And there is no success or failure in evolution, is there?
Well, there is.
Well,
I don't see any Cro-Magnon man walking around, so there is some failure. Right?
Well, yeah. But I'm talking about in the context of humanity today.
No, there isn't. There isn't. And I've got a great narrative around this.
Please.
Too, when you're
mm-hmm.
done.
Go ahead.
So, you know, people say to me, well, I keep failing. And I said, there's only one failing. They said, what? And I'm like, failing to get up when you fall down.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only failing, right? You're not moving from game to game. You're playing a single game, right? And every mistake, you know, it was amazing. So occasionally I work with addicts. And I was at a fundraiser party last week for mental health awareness. And this guy had come up to me and said, will you work my son? He's an alcoholic. I was 23 years old. And I said, sure. And I was given a speech at the event. So I was sitting outside by the pool and I was meditating in the cool air. And my eyes open and I see this kid and he's beelining for the bar. And so I'm like, oh, shit, I better get up. And so I walk over to him. He's waiting in line for the bar. And I looked at him and he knew who I was. And he knew his dad had asked me to speak to him. And he just kind of had these big eyes. And I said, you want to talk? He goes, yeah, I want to talk. And this is going to blow your mind because of what you just said. I said to him, I said, why are you having problems with alcohol? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, that's an escape. What are you escaping from? Right? He's like, I'm not living up to my potential. I'm like, you are 23 years old. You don't even know what potential is, nor should you. Right? And he goes, I am scared to death to fail or to make a mistake. I'm like, you should be making all of the mistakes right now. That's what being 23 is about, is going out and making massive amounts of mistakes, doing all the things to discover. You only discover who you are when you discover who you're not. You only discover your passion when you understand what it isn't. And I said, look, here's the mistake kids your age make, especially where I live here in Utah. They get married at 19, they have kids, and they wake up to what you just said to me, or what I'm saying to you, at 35. So a guy wakes up one day when he's 35 years old and goes, oh my God, I hate my job. I hate my life. I love my kids. I love my wife. But I'm literally not doing anything I'm passionate about. And I said, you know what happens to that guy? And he goes, no. I said, that guy just goes, well, I have an obligation to fulfill with my wife and my family. I'm like, don't get there. Right now, give yourself permission to go out and make all the mistakes. Give yourself permission to fall down 1,000 times. And you know, I actually, and I don't know what age your listeners are, but I equated it to a video game for them. Because, you know, the kids like these video games. And it's like, I said, do you believe in heaven? And do you believe in God? And he goes, I do. Right? So you believe there's somewhere we came from and that we're going to? And he goes, yeah. And I said, then you essentially just admitted that you're an avatar in a video game. And he goes, well, what? And I said, well, if there's somewhere we come from and somewhere we're going to after we die, then essentially this is not base reality. That is, you inserted yourself into this reality. And let me ask you, when you play a video game, is the point not to make mistakes? And he goes, no, it's to make all the mistakes to figure out how to beat the game. Mm. I said, there's life. Make all the mistakes. Because only in finding out where you're wrong will you find out the truth.
Yeah.
Only in the not knowing do you have a chance to live.
My guest is James Purpura, and we're talking about perception is not seeing. And we're going to talk more about this. Powerful-U.com is the website. I'm Richard Dugan. You are listening to Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Growing up, I had a happy, normal childhood. Shortly after turning 8, all of that changed. I didn't know what sexual abuse was, and I felt very dirty, and I hated my body.
When we're children, we don't get a choice in what our subconscious minds decide that we're going to believe and take into our future. We're taking anything that's fed to us as truth, and what that does to us is that says, this environment is bigger than me, and so obviously they must be right, and I must be wrong. And that belief goes deep, and it goes to the core.
Remember the first day I went into the special ed class, the teacher called me up in front of the room, and she goes, I don't know if you know this or not, but only stupid and retarded kids go to special ed.
When a young person is rejected, that physiological state creates a context for the shaping of the brain, such that certain meanings also get attached, where those meanings can be incredibly negative, negative about oneself, negative about the world. The meaning is, I don't matter.
I started to give up hope. So in order to cope with that pain, I started doing drugs.
I decided that day that I was going to end my life. So I went into the bathroom to hang myself. I could feel myself dying, and all I could see is darkness.
I got arrested, and it was apparent that I wasn't going to get out this time. When I hit that cell and I heard that door close, it's like a sound you've never heard before.
Almost all of our behaviors, all of our beliefs, our loves are all grounded in perception. Perception touches everything. It touches art, it touches beauty, it touches music. Everything begins with perception.
You will never fix what you're not willing to face. You'll never win your war by running from your battle. Right? The hurt might not be your fault, but the healing is your responsibility.
When you open your eyes and look around, of course you see a world because that world exists. The question is, are you seeing it accurately? And I think all of us have an underlying assumption that our perception of the world is the world. Well, I'd like to challenge that.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. James Purpura is my guest. He is the co-founder, along with his wife, Steph, of the Powerful-U, the letter U, powerful-u.com, the program that is available to everybody. Just go to that website. We will be linked to it. There are two elements that I have come to understand, at least from the standpoint of addressing them, incorporating them into my life. One of them is choice. I wrote a book called Choices, and it talks about step one is make a choice. But again, it goes back to that same issue of not having the experience, being exposed to new ideas, new concepts, new people, new places, et cetera, where you don't know that you have other choices. So it makes it very difficult to choose something that you don't know even exists. But even more importantly, and you talked about this a little bit, we have been told to fear the one constant in the universe. You take a look at the cosmos and you watch how things are moving and crashing and exploding and whirling and spinning and flying around. And we sit here on Earth looking through the Hubble telescope going, oh, wow, is that cool? Wow, it's kind of like watching fireworks, right? What you're watching is the constant in the universe, change. And we have been told to fear it, to do everything. You use the term uncertain times. And I love it when I hear the economists talk about whatever the, I don't care what the numbers are, it doesn't matter. And they usually end the report by saying, in these uncertain times, to which I throw up the question, could you tell me when was the last time we had certain times? And the answer I already know is never. We have never had certain times. And so change.
The only constant is change.
Yeah,
right?
The only constant is change. And we need to love it, embrace it, use it with the other C, choices.
So I'm going to address two different things you said in that.
Go for it.
The first one is choices. And so here's what's interesting. I'm going to change the way you look at choices. Okay. Because we're going to bring perception into the conversation right now. So in the way that people think about choices, we don't actually have choices. Okay, and here's why. You talked about, you know, these people that are on welfare and different things. And it's like, wake up to your choices or get the education you need, right? And so I want to challenge the whole idea of choice and then make people understand where choice lies and where choice doesn't lie, right? And so the question is this. Can you have the thing that you want most in the world sitting right in front of your face and not see it?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And so we use a really simple story to illustrate this. I want you to picture a man. This man wants more than anything to be loved. This man wants to be in a relationship, but he has abysmal low self-esteem, poor self-image of himself. One day, this guy walks into the store, walks up to the counter, and the girl behind the counter starts flirting with him. My question for you, Richard, is, does he see it?
Probably not.
That's the same answer I get from every single person. Probably not. And so the question is, why doesn't he see it? And the answer is always, well, you said he had low self-esteem. So you're saying that something inside of him is dictating what he sees on the outside. And the title of the book and movie is Perception, Seeing is Not Believing. Well, what if seeing is not believing? What is it? Believing is seeing. The reason the guy does not see the girl flirting with him, it's because he doesn't believe it's possible because of his low self-esteem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in this moment, he does not have the choice to flirt back because he does not see that as an opportunity. Right? So the question is, well, how does he see it? What is he seeing? He's seeing an assumption of what he thinks reality is. Base reality in this situation, you know, like the objective reality is the girl's there, she's flirting with him, but he can't see it. Now, the question I would have for your listeners is, what if that's happening to you? What if the things that you want most in the world are sitting right in front of your face and you just can't see them? And my answer to you is it's happening to you every single day. Because most people see this as an acute story as something that happens occasionally. No, it happens every day. And the answer is why? And it's because seeing is believing. Believing is not seeing. Seeing is believing. And here's why. If that guy believed it was possible, if the guy had self-esteem to support it, he would have clearly seen the girl was flirting with him. Right? But because he didn't, he didn't. And the answer, the question is why. And here's why. It's a capacity thing. Any given second, your mind is processing millions of bits of information in your subconscious mind. You're taking in everything, right? And so your perception's job is to take all that information and compress it down to the most important pieces for you, right? And so it's like, okay, well, this is what's going on, and it delivers to you that to you as your reality, and that's your reality. Well, what is? How does it decide what's important? Well, it's based on your belief structure. It doesn't waste time looking for things that you don't believe is possible, just like you would not go to the end of the rainbow and look for a pot of gold because you don't believe it's there. Your perception, this guy's perception, is not looking for a girl flirting with him, because he doesn't even believe it's possible for a girl to flirt with him based on his low self-esteem, right? And so essentially what's happening is that your beliefs are being projected on the screen of the world, and that's what you're interacting with constantly because that's all you can see. And so how does the guy see the girl flirting with him? Right? Mm-hmm. If he changes what he believes about himself, on the inside, he sees something different on the outside. And so when we go back to choice, this is what I would tell you, is every day, each and every one of us have similar experiences. Every day, based on our current state of awareness, our mind applies the same meaning to those experiences it did yesterday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so our mind applies the same meaning. With that same meaning, we go, oh, well, I know what this means. What do? We make the same decision we did yesterday. And that's what we call a perception loop. It's wash, rinse, repeat. Same information, same meaning, same decision. Well, the question is it the right meaning, right? Because you can't make a good decision on bad meaning. And here's what I would say to everybody is, Richard, you've never made a bad decision in your life. And I'm sure you're saying to me, thinking, you're crazy. I've made a lot of bad decisions. But the answer is you haven't, unless you're a sociopath or mentally ill. And you're like, James, I've made a lot of bad decisions. And I would say that you haven't because you make decisions the same way I make decisions. You look at all of the available information, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you, in that moment, make the decision at that time you think is in your best interest, right? It may not work out that way. And so what's the difference? It's that you've only ever made decisions based on bad information. Why is that narrative important? Here's why it's important. It's important because you're not the problem. It's an information problem, period. Because you make decisions the same way I make decisions. If I have a better life or a better experience, it's because I have better information. Well, where does that information come from? It comes from my past. It comes from my beliefs. It comes from my interpretations. So here's what we say to people quite often is that if your life is not what you want it to be, it's not that you've done anything wrong. You made the only decision you could with the information that you had available to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you change your life? Well, there's only one way. You have to change the information. Well, how do you change the information? You step into the not knowing. But that's counterintuitive because the way your mind works, it works in microseconds. You walk into a room and instantly you know what's going on. But you think you know what's going on because your mind does something similar to a Google search. It literally goes and it accesses your memories and says, all right, hey, what does this mean? And instantly it returns the result. And what it means is it goes back and it looks for experiences that were very similar to this in the past and applies the same meaning it did last time. Here's the inherent problem, right? Is that that meaning was wrong last time, and you use that decision to make, or that meaning to make a decision, then that decision is compromised. Now you're placing the same meaning, which was wrong last time, the decision was compromised again, and that's, you know, 20 years down the road, you're nowhere near you think where your life is supposed to be, and you're questioning why. Because none of it seems to make sense, but it actually makes perfect sense, right? Mm. Everything in your life is a direct reflection of what you feel on the inside. Look, I can talk to people all the time and I'm like, hey, listen, I can tell you what you believe about money. And they're like, you can you? And I said, yeah, let me see your bank accounts. Let me see your credit card statements. I can tell you what you believe about relationships by looking at your relationships. I can tell you what you believe about your career by examining your career. I can just simple questions.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no mystery to it. Everybody's on a path to somewhere. Without interruption, you are going to end up in that path. And people act like there's blinders on and they have no idea. You know, they end up somewhere and like, how did I get here? Why is God punishing me? God's not punishing you. You know, I see people all the time that eat terribly, smoke, do different things, and they end up with cancer or heart disease, and they're like, oh my God, why me? I'm like, why you? Why you? Because you were on that path and you failed to be honest with yourself. And so, look, I want all your listeners to understand is that you don't have to guess where your life's going to end up.
Yeah.
It's very simple. Look at your finances. Where were you 1 year ago today? Did you have more money? Did you have less money? Were you more in debt? Were you less in debt? Take that number and move that forward 1 year and add 10% to it. What did you weigh this time last year, right? Did you weigh less or did you weigh more? Are you moving up the scale or are you moving down the scale? Were your relationships better or worse? This is just a continuum. There is no mystery to what's going on here. So the question is, how do we interrupt that cycle? And it is, in fact, an information problem. It's people don't have choice because they assume that they see reality. And so that person on welfare who's stuck in that cycle, right, does not see the opportunities that are all around them, just like we don't see the opportunities that are all around us. We have to open up. We have to step into the not knowing, which is the second part of what you said, is the fear of uncertainty. Why are people so afraid of change? And I've got a crazy narrative, but I want to, before I switch over from there to fear and change, I want to make sure that I give you a chance to respond to the choice thing that I just went over.
Well, I will tell you that I've had this analogy that I've used in light of what you just shared. I often would say, you know, I've been doing this for, you know, and I was working my way towards my 40th year in this business. I've been doing this since I was 19. I've got this massive toolbox. It's enormous. It's like bigger than a shed or a storage unit, filled with all of the tools I could possibly ever want to do whatever I want to do. And there are times when I say to myself, man, you know, you'd think with all the experience I've got, I would be further along in my career. But then, of course, I look at where I'm at and I'm going, you know, this ain't bad. I mean, you know, sure, I don't necessarily envy, say, Larry King for his position, because he went down his path, he did his thing, and that's where he is. And maybe it's not part of my goal in life necessarily, or my contract, for some people who believe the concept of reincarnation and so forth, maybe it's not in my contract to be nationally or internationally known. Just to do your thing, get the word out, help people the best you can, and enjoy where you're at. And I mean, okay, I can live with that. That's okay. But again, that every once in a while, that thing creeps in about, I've got the tools. I've got all these tools. It's like having a hammer and not knowing, why can't I build a house, you know, kind of thing. And so when you talk about this, then as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about that analogy going, all right, so if, setting aside the whole contract thing, if I wanted more next year at this time, I wanted something bigger, better, stronger, faster, what have you, then there are things that I have to do. And first of all, I have to get through to myself that, A, I'm worthy of that level. That higher level of awareness by others, of being listened to by more people, of having bigger, stronger, faster guests, or whatever the case might be. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from now, reevaluating that analogy of the toolbox or tool shed, if you will, and the fact that I can do anything I want. And I can accomplish whatever I want, but I have to do it. And the first step is getting beyond the beliefs that have told me that, maybe it's the contract. Maybe I'm not, because that's still a belief that I believe
That's just a narrative.
A narrative. So right. I have to rewrite the narrative saying, no, this is what I want. This is where I'd like to be. I would love to be able to get through to more people, get through and help other people doing, providing the kind of information you provide and many of our other guests provide to help them to lift themselves up, to awaken their consciousness, to know that there is a better life out there for all of us, not just a select few.
So, all right, Richard, two things. So go to our website and I'll send you a free code, Richard, to take our assessment.
I was just going to ask you about that. The sketch.
Right, the perception sketch. And I want you to take it because you have tools, but there are beliefs that are keeping you from using those tools. Mm-hmm. And perception sketch, which is an assessment that goes in and tells you what's in your subconscious mind. And we've had to rewrite the results 3 times because it's so jarring to people sometimes that they immediately reject it and won't read the full thing. So we had to soften the front end and kind of kiss them before we slap them. because... These people, you know, they're like, this isn't me until we explain it. And they're like, well, this is exactly me. So I would welcome you to go do that because you have the tools, but what you don't have is you don't know what beliefs are preventing you from using those tools. And so Perception Sketch will uncover those beliefs. And I don't want to tell you too much more about it because if I tell you about it, then it's going to skew your test results. And I want to give you the pure experience. Richard, if that's where you're at, if you want to change, go in and find out what beliefs are holding you back. It will tell you exactly that.
I make the commitment to you and to our listeners. I will do that.
Okay. Number two is this. Is we were talking about this idea of fear, right? All right, and I'm going to try it. This is a long narrative, so I'm going to cut it down as short as I can. All right, and what do we got? How much time we got left?
Oh, we got more than enough time, 15, 20, 25 minutes, whatever you've got to give us.
Okay, yeah, I've got about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so essentially this, what is your biggest fear? And so we all have the biggest fear. We fear death. And you may not fear dying, but you do fear death because it's in your DNA to fear death, right? And so the question is that there are three types of death that we fear. The first one is fear of potential death, which is the fear of uncertainty, right? And so the question is, why do we fear uncertainty? And we have to go back to our early days of our existence when we existed in tribes. The fear of uncertainty is in our DNA because essentially what happened was is that if we have everything where we're currently at, we'd never venture into new territory, because venturing to new territory mean that we had to take on potential death, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we wouldn't leave where we were to go to somewhere new unless we ran out of food, which meant we were going to die for sure. So, you know, this is most people's models of change, is that they don't change until the fear of changing now outweighs the fear of not changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the fear of uncertainty. The second type of death that we fear, right, is the fear of instant death. We don't do things that will kill us, right? We don't walk into traffic. We don't jump off bridges. We don't, obviously, unless you're in that state of mind, but we don't do things that will kill us. But fortunately enough for us as a species, we've spent eons mapping those things out. We put signs on them. We put fences around them. Don't touch this. Don't do that or you will die, right? We put a little stickers on them. So we don't think about instant death much anymore unless we get into near death accident or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that we don't walk around with that fear on our sleeves. But there is one form of death that's scarier. People say it all the time. I don't mind dying. I just don't want to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's the fear of ugly death. And there is an evolutionary equivalent to ugly death. Okay? And that is, when we existed in tribes, Richard, we didn't have a concept or even a word for I. There was no I. There was only we. They didn't even have a word for it, because we inherently knew that our survival was dependent on one another. And so essentially what would happen is, if you got rejected or kicked out of the tribe, right, then you were dead in a very short period of time. You don't know how, you don't know when. And by the way, it's going to be excruciatingly painful because you're probably going to be eaten. There was no survival outside of the tribe, because it takes 10 guys with a stick to fight off a bear. There's just no way around it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you could not exist alone. You know, there's no hardware stores, no guns. There's no, right. I mean, it's sticks and stones.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, the equivalent in our DNA for ugly death is the concept of rejection, right? And so what happens when you're rejected from the tribe? You only have two ways to live at this point in time. The first way is you can gain acceptance of the tribe and they can let you back in. And this is what creates our need for acceptance as human beings. The second way is that you can gain control, right, by killing the tribe leader and taking control of the tribe. Now, I've walked people through something called an emotional integration technique. And what an emotional integration technique is it's going into your past and going to your past experience and imprinting a new emotion on past experiences, so that the next time your perception pulls that experience to dictate your current reality, it doesn't come with a negative emotional response. You know, it's all of a sudden you're having a discussion, you're pissed off, and you're like, why am I so pissed? It's because the past experience, somebody used a word that triggered a past experience that had a negative emotion tied to it. So we go in and we tie new emotions to past experiences, and that's how we create happiness. But every time I take somebody back in and I go into a massive amount of anger, we always end up at the same place, and that's their first notable rejection. So I'm going to demonstrate the nightmare that's playing itself out on this planet right now and why the world is in that state we talked about at the beginning. So when you were rejected from the first time, a massive rejection, whether this rejection was from your parents, a teacher's, peers, you experienced an identity crisis. It happens to all of us. And essentially what happens is inside of this meat suit we're wearing, there is primal programming. And there are things that are programmed into this meat suit, right? And this is one of them. The second you are rejected massively, the fight for your survival just began. Because when you're little, you don't see yourself as separate from your parents. You're part of the we, right? And when you're rejected, then for the first time, the concept of I is introduced to you. And by the way, whatever you are is now not good enough. So in order to survive, this primal program inside of you says one of two things. You either need to gain acceptance, right? And this is why social media is so popular. It's a massive validation machine. Mm-hmm. Please accept me, please accept me, please accept me. Or you need to gain control, right? And so this is the nightmare lie that's playing out on the planet. Everybody's running around trying to gain acceptance. And if they can't gain acceptance, they're trying to control others. Some people are doing it on a massive scale, right? You think about World War II, 70 million people died in or because of World War II. And we are still trying to figure out better ways to kill each other. That's insane, Richard. Mm-hmm. That's insane thinking. The question is why? It's because when we have this identity crisis, the first thing, the first split that happens inside of us is we feel this idea of separation. I am alone. I am separate from you. Whatever I am is not good enough. And so what do I need to do to survive? Well, I've got to gain acceptance. Well, what I am is not good enough, so I need to become something different. And this is where your ego takes over and it spins up a new persona and says, well, is this good enough? Well, that's not good enough either. So we keep spinning up personas until we feel like we gain acceptance. And if we can't get the acceptance we need, or we can't gain, we're not strong enough to gain control, then we check out through addiction or suicide, right? And that's the nightmare that's running out on this planet. And so essentially what happens is that your ego takes over, starts spinning up personas to get accepted. But the problem is these personas aren't you. They are a persona that you made up to be accepted. So you were trying to gain acceptance for what you're not, not for what you are, because what you are is now buried under 1,000 personas. Because the most authentic, pure version of you, you deem that as not good enough. So not only are you running full speed away from it, right? You also probably hate it. And so that those personas, you're trying to gain acceptance for a persona. That's why acceptance never works. Because you inherently know this isn't who you are that you're trying to gain acceptance for. The second thing that happens is this idea of me versus you, right? Mm-hmm. When we feel that rejection, this starts that whole narrative that I am separate and alone and that I need to fight for my survival, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where the me versus you scenario. Richard, our lives, we are still 100% dependent on each other in order to survive. We just don't realize it because we go to grocery stores, right? Because globalization, right? But everybody's running around with this me versus for you for scenario. And this is where the idea of scarcity comes in. In order for me to succeed, somebody else has to lose. Right. And so this idea of scarcity, right, is that idea that separations like causes every war, causes every disagreement, right? And it causes this idea that there's never enough of anything because I'm now fighting for my survival. The third thing that happens is that this is the in this moment, you feel contempt for the first time. Right? Whatever I am is not good enough, so I resent whoever made me that way. Now, if you externalize this contempt, Richard, this is what becomes like what we refer to as your victim. The world has harmed me and deemed me as not good enough, right? Now, I can justify doing harm to others. right?
Yeah.
And so when people have this victim mentality, because what happened to you feels very much outside of your control, right?
Yeah.
That's what justifies you doing harm to others, taking from others, doing harm to others, because you feel like they've done massive harms to you because they put your survival at stake, the worst thing they could possibly do, right? And again, this is all a program that's running. If you internalize that shadow and that contempt, this is the start of mental illness. This is the path towards suicide. This is the self-deprecation of beating yourself up. If you're one of those people who constantly beats yourself up, you know, this is the march towards things like suicide and school shootings, right? Because they internalize it, and it still feels like somebody did this to them, but they internalize it, and this goes to a dark and ugly place. And to some degree, we all have pieces of that thing failing, playing out in our lives. And so the last one is the introduction of shame, right? Mm. You know, it's like you're ashamed for who you are. That's what you've been made to feel, right? But you're more ashamed for now who you have to become. So I was saying, the saying is, what if you're everything that you think that you're not and nothing that you think that you are? And I can prove to you that's the most likely scenario. Because the real version of you, right, is buried under 1,000 personas. And you're playing a primal game. And that game is to fight for your survival. But there is a lie that goes underneath all of this, Richard. And I'll demonstrate this. It's like, you would think, right, that if we keep playing cowboys and Indians, we have the oppressed and the oppressor, right? But what happens when the oppressed takes control? You know, you'd think they'd be kind and loving because they've now been oppressed, but they become the oppressor, right? We keep flip-flopping oppressor and oppressed. Mm-hmm. Nelson Mandela was the first one in history to go, we can't do that. We have to stop, right? Mm-hmm. That's why he was such an interesting human being. But here's the lie. Richard, I could come over to your house. I could take away all of your clothes. I could take away all of your money. I could take away your cars. And I could kick you outside. I got a question for you. Are you going to survive?
I'm going to say yes.
Yes. So survival is the lie.
Mm-hmm.
Our survival is not at stake. We all feel like we're fighting for our survival and we're in pain because of that fight. But our survival was never at stake because we are no longer playing a survival level game. So the program that is running this game inside of us is, in fact, outdated. And most people don't even know it's running.
Mm.
Right? You know, I see people all the time like, hey, we need to do a program to take care of the environment. I'm like, it'll never work. And they're like, why? I'm like, because if we don't lead people out of pain, they're never going to take care of right? Yeah. Because the only thing they can see is their own pain.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so the question is, this is a needs versus wants.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of what when you said, I've got these tools, why aren't you using them? And I'm going to tell you why. Because needs always trump wants. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you're moving down a path towards your goal and a survival need, which is the most powerful need, comes up, whether it's validation or control, and control is trying to control your situation and everything else to make yourself feel safe. Feeling safe is a survival need. You do not have a choice when that program is running inside of you. You will always move towards survival. There's zero choice in that. So the question is, if survival is no longer on the table, that means there's nothing you need to do. Mm-hmm. Because you are, in fact, safe. I mean, I think it's amazing. We live in the safest time in recorded history. Yet we feel, because of the globalization of news, we feel like we live in the most dangerous time.
Yeah.
The idea is there's nothing, Richard, there's nothing you need to do to survive. Now, what can you do?
Yeah. And that's the next question that we'll have to address on another program. One of the things I wanted to talk to
you. I want to give the answer to that.
Oh, really, I beg your pardon. Go ahead.
Just one more answer.
Sure.
Whatever you want to do, because the underlying lie between that survival game is fear. Your survival is never at stake. So there is zero reason to fear. Your fears are not real. That's the basis for fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing to severe. You don't have to do anything, which means you get to do whatever you want.
Right.
And that's the answer to your question.
Well, one of the phrases I've come up with over the years, because survival, okay, you know, people are always talking about living from paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, I'm not alone in that regard from up to a certain level. But I want to help people to move. And this is my phrase. I've even coined a new word in it. I want to move us from survival mode to thrival mode. And I think that for the most part, and this is kind of the way that I look at this, and maybe it's because I moved to Santa Barbara. I've been here 13 plus years. I've been through 13 fires around us, only evacuated once. When the first one showed up in 2006, I freaked out. I was like the proverbial chicken with his head cut off, not knowing what to do, who to call, where to go, how to do this, that, or the other thing. And then it shifted into, over the years, to frustration and even anger over the stupidity of people who started these fires, to now saying, you know what? I'm not going to worry about these things, because if we have to do what we have to do, and we did once have to evacuate, we'll do what's necessary to keep ourselves safe. And when we were out for 10 days, I wasn't fearful of losing our place of living, which we were renting. I wasn't afraid of losing our jobs. I was actually having a great time. We stayed at three different hotels that we never would have stayed at in the first place. Enjoyed going back to the hotel after work and then eating out, which was nice. The insurance company, we have rental insurance, so they covered the majority of our expenses. We made a new friend who said, the next time this happens, if we're safe and secure, you come stay with us. They have more than enough room. And I just looked at it as, this is kind of cool. I mean, this is like a staycation. I wasn't fearful. It's like, you know, you asked the question more rhetorically about the fear of death. I'm not afraid. If today is my day, I'm good with that. I'm good to go. Now, the whole suffering thing, that may be another aspect that I would think about. But I don't have a problem with this process. As a matter of fact, when someone that I know passes away or someone famous, one of the first things that goes to my mind is, I wonder what they're experiencing. I wonder what they're going through. I would love to.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I don't fear that either. It's the next evolution. I'm not ready for it.
No.
But I'm not worried about it either.
Yeah. Well, I look at it this way. Is there more that I want to do in my life? I have plans on living plans. Those are my plans, not the universe's plans, of living another at least 40 years. I have to outlive my great-grandmother who lived to be 100. All right? And so I got a minimum of 40 more years, literally a lifetime. And the things that I can do in that 40 years, I'm very excited about that prospect. But if today is my day, hey, there isn't anything. It's kind of like being abducted by aliens. Is there really anything you can do about that? I don't think so. if they want you, they're going
That's
to take you.
That's a whole different show, Richard. Let's not bring up the aliens.
No. But I'm just saying that there are certain things that you don't have control over, and that's one of them is the process of transitioning into whatever the next life is. Some people have fear of it because they're afraid that it's lights out. And I say, well, let me put it to you this way. First of all, if it is lights out, you're not going to know anyway. So it doesn't matter. All right.
It's all good. Look, Richard, you know, the tools that we have on our website will help people with the things they can change.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? The things you can change, because you can change your life. I got to wrap up with
sure.
this, but I'll tell your listeners this one thing. Guys, if you're feeling alone, if you're feeling desperate, if you're feeling like nobody understands you or hears you or sees you, I want to let you know that I see you. I've been there. I've felt your pain.
Yeah.
I've experienced the lowest lows. But there is hope. And there's nothing wrong with you. The only thing you're experiencing, if you're not living the life you want, is an information problem. It's time to upgrade your information and upgrade your experience. Right? You can't make good decisions on bad information. It's impossible. Your perception is full of bad information. It's time to upgrade your perception, upgrade your view of the world. It's time to step out of the knowing into the magic of the unknowing, and you can create whatever you want for your life. Your life can be magical.
And by the way, folks, there's a movie. It's called Perception. Seeing is not believing. And what's beautiful is that it does hit the ground running, basically today, saying not only that we are a species that needs to change to continue, and I love the fact that you use this word, to continue thriving, because that tells me, James, that you already believe that we are thriving at one level, but that it's time to evolve. So to that end, I want to thank you for this first interview. I guarantee we're going to have you and your wife back to talk more about this, because there is a lot more, because I would love to talk about the tools that you folks have in your toolbox or your tool shed or building to offer to people to help them go through this process, but also to talk more about, of course, what your wife has experienced over the years progressing, and also wanting to invite you, should you be here in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you both here in studio to continue this conversation, although, hey, we'll do it by Skype or whatever it takes.
Perfect. Hey, Richard, thank you so much. You know, I got to tell you, this was a different conversation than I've had with anybody else, and I really enjoyed it. You know, we have the book, Perception, Seeing, Not Believing. We have the movie, Perception, Seeing, Not Believing. This book and movie will open your eyes to a whole new reality. I would recommend everybody that's listening to go to our website, powerful-U, to watch to get the book, get the movie, Barnes & Noble, you can get it. Thank you, Richard, and have a fantastic day. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I did, too, and I have three final questions for you. Very briefly, you may have answered them to some degree during the interview, but I like to ask them pointedly, directly. First one is, who is James Purpura?
James is on a man on a journey to evolve.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Break people free of their false limiting beliefs and narratives to help them rewrite their stories.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To evolve and to help others evolve.
And I thank you so much for joining us again. And I thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.